This is a production of Cornell University.
Okay, we are going to go ahead and get started here. Let me pull up the proper agenda to keep myself on track. And here we go. So the first set of items we have are approval of minutes that we were foregoing until a later date due to the work that we are doing. So we have the minutes from April 10th, 17th, 18th, and 24th. I don't know actually if the 24th are in there, if they're in the box, but I know the 10th, 17th, and 18th are in the box. Hope everyone could have accessed the link that was hyperlinked in the email. If not, let me know, but I'm looking for motion to approve the February 10th minutes or anything else. Yeah, Barb.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Sorry to wave so hard when there's this many. I don't know how to best get your attention, but I did have, first of all, I thank, is it Matt? Are you the one that's been doing these minutes? Awesome job. I had one thing that I did want to note that I don't believe I said. It might've been somebody else or maybe I don't think I would have said this, but it's on the April 18th minutes, item Z. It's about section 6.3, what circumstances would prior findings of responsibility not be admissible? And the comment that's attributed to me is that past findings unrelated to the current charges would be unduly prejudicial. I think somebody else might have offered that viewpoint. I offered the point, I believe, or certainly intended to, that prior findings of Cornell disciplinary records would always be relevant at a sanctioning stage.
Thank you for the correction. I will fix that.
Thank you. Yeah. Sorry to offer anything.
Yeah, Christina.
Great job.
No, thank you.
Thanks, Joe. So yeah, I'm looking at the April 10th meetings and there is a comment under the limitations period. It's towards the bottom of page 3. And the minutes say that, the minutes say that I made a comment that it's important in some cases to let students file after they graduate. I'm sorry, I no longer remember what I said, but that doesn't sound like something I would say. So I don't know if there's a proper substitute or just to remove it because that doesn't remind me of anything I made. Said.
Okay, we can fix that too.
Thank you, Matt.
Yeah, thank you.
Anything else on any of the minutes? Because I'll just consider approving the 10th, 17th, and 18th minutes all into one motion. So motion to approve all three. So whenever there is everyone finds them all acceptable. If someone could just motion that and someone could second, that'd be great.
Motion to pass the minutes.
Perfect, thank you, Bryce. And do I have a second on that?
Second.
A second from Laura, thank you, Laura. Okay, all in favor of approving the minutes from the 10th, 17th, and 18th. You can chat it or you can just do the nice little buttons in the participants tab. Yes, no. I don't see anything in chat, but it does pass 5-0-1. So those minutes pass. So now we'll be moving into business of the day, which is review of public comments. And I pulled out three of them because those were the three that we specifically made some asks of the community to publicly comment on in our procedures draft and then other sections as necessary. So yeah, I hope everyone had a chance to read, the packet that I sent out that was noted at 5 p.m. A lot of the public comments, you know, didn't surprise me all that much in content. A lot focused on the standard of evidence, you know, standard of proof, a lot focused on the role of the JCC, you know, so there were a lot of themes in there. Also, there were a lot of alumni commenting, and I feel important to point that out. You know, it's great that alumni do, but I think, you know, there's a perspective always there. So we had a lot of alumni comments, which shocked me initially at first, but, you know, I read through them. So if you didn't have a chance, you know, we can pull things out. I mean, some of the comments we can't do much about other than re-talk about the issue, because I think the issue is an indicative kind of issue, like the standard of proof that, you know, our group might not solve. And it's really now up to the UA to kind of have their vote on it as well. But, you know, that's kind of how I think through things. Yeah, Risa.
Yeah, thanks. I was also just scrolling down and I see that there are some new comments. I haven't had a chance to read through them, and I would like to do that. You know, I'm not sure I can do that right this minute, but it looks like there's a good number of them that have come in within the time that we set, which is today, which would be total, you know, all day, not because we happen to be meeting at 9 o'clock in the morning. So we do have quite a few here, actually, some to take a look at. But to address what you were talking about in terms of what we're going to do today, my thought was that since we have comments coming in, and we had quite a few comments coming in, and I know I read them carefully, and I'm sure other people did too, that this is potentially a time for us to actually consider the comments, the fact that we voted originally and sent this, you know, particulars to the UA doesn't mean that we can't review some things. And I know I have an idea about something that I think could address comments that were raised. And I think some people made some good points that I didn't necessarily think of. So I hope that we can look at everything that is relevant to these comments.
Yeah, I built in time at the end of the meeting. The 3 points that we talk about, I don't think they're going to be very long. I think the vast majority of our meeting is going to be dedicated to the comments. So we just have to get through these 3 things real quick just to re-review them, because I think there are things that we wanted to change in them or things that we wanted to come back to, but I think the conversation will be fairly quick on those and we can move straight into the public comments.
Okay,
so I will share my screen on the procedures that we're looking at. That's not the one. Here we go. Is this the one? Trying to connect, very fuzzy energy. Okay, perfect. So the first one we had to look at to finish off was section 4.3 of the procedures. This one related to the transcript notation while the conduct process is proceeding. Yeah. And so last night, Gabrielle can't be with us today. She has an exam tomorrow morning that she is studying for. She sent an email to me about what could potentially be put here. You know, as a middle ground option, we were pretty much, the committee kind of, you know, from our initial vote, wanted to change this language somehow. And so Gabrielle suggested some language on that, and that's in the comment right over here. So I'll give people some time to read the comment, and then if someone wants to, you know, if someone agrees with it, take a crack at it, just give initial thoughts. Just speak when ready, because I can't see everyone as I share my screen.
I see James's hand.
Yeah.
James, go for it.
Good morning, everyone. Just from talking to Gabby last night, I think the main difference between what she wrote in this and the original proposal was that this would allow the OJA to impose a transcript notation if someone withdraws from the university before final, some type of adjudication, which wasn't necessarily, which was a loophole and not necessarily clear in the first iteration.
Joe, it's Jen. A student will download their transcript and apply for it before they withdraw so that it wouldn't have the notation. So it doesn't, I would say that doesn't make sense. Once they withdraw, they've planned it out. They're withdrawing for a reason. And this isn't just directed to Joe, it's directed to the committee. So if they're going to withdraw because they have a sanction pending, they're going to get their transcript before they withdraw if they know it's going to go on thereafter. So it just doesn't seem to make sense to post it after they withdraw.
Okay. Yeah, James.
Yeah, that might be true. I think you're right on that. But I think the only thing I can think of is that I know for graduate schools, I'm not sure. I've not applied to a job since graduating Cornell undergrad because I'm still in law school. But I know for grad schools, I think the university sends, and the university has to be the one to send the transcript to the grad school. Because otherwise, if you download the official transcript as a student, it says void on it. And the only official one that you get has to come from the school directly. So I would imagine that if someone was applying for things down the road, that it would show up. I don't know if you could use it like the old transcripts, but I'm not sure on that. I'm sure people know more about that than I do.
Risa.
Yeah, on that point, my experience has been that when I get transcripts, it's from the, there are different ways I guess it could be done, but in terms of when I really need an official transcript, I get it from the university. I don't get transcripts only from a student sending them.
Right, I meant download, there's a clearinghouse where students can access their transcripts. It's either like getmytranscript.com or something like that, where national clearinghouses hold transcripts and then you can go online and order them. I didn't mean like download them from Student Center. Sorry about that.
But if you can order them, then, you know, I mean, it seems to me that this is a good compromise, that if somebody withdraws, that then it's placed on there. I think that's a good compromise that. I don't know that this is a good way to think about this, that somebody's going to game the system. It seems to me that what we're thinking about is what's fair to do. And this seems fair to say that that we don't notate the transcript during the pendency of formal complaint unless the student withdraws. I mean, it's clear, and it gives us a timing issue as opposed to the student might withdraw. I mean, that doesn't make sense.
Jen, did you have a hand up?
No, thank you.
Okay. Yeah, Bryce.
So I guess if I'm understanding correctly what's been said, in theory, someone could order a transcript prior to the end of the semester, and then they would only have an annotation of the classes they're hypothetically taking for that semester. So they would lose a semester of credits if they, if they had a transcript sent, to reflect the fact that these transcripts usually come from graduate schools, or two graduate schools from Cornell. But even if, you know, someone else accepts an informal transcript, you know, they would have to download it before that final semester is, you know, before they've withdrawn from that final semester of that. Is that right?
Bryce, could you repeat that?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Jay.
Okay. Trying to like look three different.
So basically I'm thinking there is a loophole, but it would require a student to, you know, essentially censor their last completed semester.
Yeah, I think I remember looking at my transcript at certain points before my grades were in, and you just say in progress. So if a student anticipated that they were going, I suppose that they were going to break the code or something and wanted to withdraw before their grades came in, then it would show that they didn't complete those credits. So I think the idea is by the time that the grades were in and the credits were viewed as completed, then that's the time when the notation would get put on if they went through the process of withdrawing.
So I was just thinking, and I think of it back to policy 6.4, if a student withdraws pending a case, it goes on their record as they're withdrawing while a case is pending. So some students choose to withdraw in the middle of the semester, but they lose those credits, which is unfortunate, right? But some people do leave midway through the semester for all kinds of reasons, but that's all.
But yeah, so Jen, I guess my point is that the loophole is always there, regardless of whether a transcript notation is put on there or not. And so to me, this language seems sufficient because someone can always use an old transcript and lose a semester and not have a notation and deceive the next school they're enrolling in or the next employer. Schools should be asking for, you know, the completed transcript, and so should employers, in my opinion.
I trust the committee to vote how they feel right.
Yeah, Logan.
Hey, everyone. I just wanted to say that in my experience as a Cornell student, every employer that I've had post-graduating and then for the law school has asked for me to go through Cornell's official transcript program to send my transcript. So I've never had the ability to send an unofficial transcript or to get one from another location.
Okay. It seems like we've exhausted some discussion on this, and I would appreciate a vote on it. So yes, if you want to accept Gabrielle's language, or no, if you don't. Andrea, are you able to just chat your vote in? So as it stands right now, it's 4-1. I can't seem to copy and paste, but I will insert language. Okay. So that one, so Gabrielle's language is going to go into that section by a vote of 4-1. the next part that I had was sections 7.3 and 7.4. And these dealt with the rights to appeal. We talked a bit about should the grounds for appeal depend on whether your party status is the complainant, the respondent, or OSCCS, should we keep them different? And that was kind of the conversation that we had around them. It's not necessarily section 7.4. I mean, there's a bit of 7.4 in it, but it's more so in 7.3 that we've talked about it. Have any initial thoughts on that again after we address this at the 18th meeting?
Can I just ask, did we get any comments? I don't recall seeing any comments on this, but I also didn't see the ones yet from this morning. Do we know?
I haven't looked at the ones from this morning, but anything that we've gotten up to 5 p.m. yesterday, we've gotten nothing on this. Anything on this?
I have a question. So in point three, where it says the hearing panel rendered a decision that is clearly erroneous, like what exactly does that mean? I guess like there's clearly an error to everyone. Like must everyone think that it was an error for an appeal to go through or?
Risa.
Yeah, so a clearly erroneous standard, and I'm looking at the, where exactly is the language here? Okay, number three for the hearing panel. So it's hard to look at just that screen, so I want to actually look at the one that I can actually move. So we're talking about 7.3 grounds for appeals from the hearing panel. So there's the list, and one of them is that the hearing panel rendered a decision that is clearly erroneous. So a clearly erroneous standard is one that's distinguishing between the appeals panel saying, well, we wouldn't have reached that. You know, we don't think that that was a really, you know, a good decision, as opposed to saying, well, whether we would have reached that decision or not, it's within the realm of something that's reasonable and that isn't clearly erroneous in the sense of, you know, it goes against something that, like the evidence is clearly outside of, you know, what the decision is. It's opposite the decision. There's something that shows it's more than, we just don't really, this is not what I would have decided. And the appeals panel is going to decide based on, you know, the vote of the appeals panel. It's not that, I don't actually remember the second. Do we have in here what the vote is? Is it a majority vote for the appeals panel?
Yeah, it's a majority vote.
Yeah, so it would be a ground that would be part of what could be argued to the appeals panel, and then they would vote a majority vote. But that's my understanding of number three. Does that help?
Yeah, sorry, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Anything else on this? If people don't have anything and are content with how it lays, I'm happy to push forward into the next discussion point. One, going once, going twice, three times, sold. I'm gonna move on from this section, seeing that no one seems to have a viewpoint or a strong viewpoint to change it. So I will move on to the next section that we have, which was section 7.5. This was the appeals procedures. It wasn't that we wanted to change any procedures, but rather tried to find a more timely timeline, I guess. this requires us to kind of look through the days and everything like that. I think we've made a decision, and this is something that I'll reflect in the finalized, you know, version of the document, that all of our days are going to be business days, not calendar days. And so I want to make that clear, if just so everyone knows, which, you know, might elongate this process, but I think we accepted the business days kind of standard. And there were also no comments on this as well from the public comment on how people felt about the timeliness of the appeals process. Risa.
Well, it seems like if we're looking for places to shave off time, you know, I'm not like, this is not an area that's really bothered me in terms of, you know, being too long. But if what people are looking for, it looks like some of the places where some time could be shaved off would be perhaps the response to an appeal, 10 business days to submit a written response. Suppose we could also say the appealing party must, well, actually the first one, I'll go in order here, the appealing party must submit an appeal to the review panel chair within, I don't know, something like, if it were 7 business days, and that should be clarified also. It just says 10 days here. I mean, 7 business days, does that make sense? And then the response, we have 10 business days, could that be shaved down to like 7 business days? The 14 business days, could that be shaved down by a couple of days? Would that help?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think anywhere we put 10, like here, we could say 7. Like you said, 14, just, we could shave this one down.
I'm just kind of throwing this out here. I mean, I'd be very interested in people's views who have actually had to go through this, you know, to say, well, what makes sense?
Yeah. Yeah, Bryce.
Yeah, I'd really like to hear what, I mean, I know that scheduling is really difficult for people, but, you know, we're giving the people who have the most at stake only 10 days here, or maybe 7. I think Risa has a good point there. I don't really understand why the panel can't also render its decision more quickly. Mm-hmm.
So I can shave this one down to 10. For the rendering of decision. And then the 20, do we feel comfortable shaving that down to 15?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think this makes sense. Anyone else want to share as part of the, yeah, Bryce?
So my only question is, the first ones are 10 and the second is 7. And so for equity reasons, I wonder if those shouldn't be 7. The first shouldn't also, well, I guess I just wonder why the appealing party is going to take 10 days and whereas the other party only gets 7.
Oh, that's fair. I can shave that down to 7 as well at the top. I also think that makes sense, but I guess I'm generalizing. If I was someone who wanted to appeal my decision, I would want the appeal to be done quickly. I'd be appealing next day if I felt like I was wronged. Okay. So we shaved down some days.
Can I just,
Risa?
I mean, in terms of the time, it's so that people have time not to say, oh, well, I have to think about whether I have a good appeal or not, but time for people to write something, I think, is the point, right? So the you know, there's some question about you know, the response to an appeal is shorter than the appeal itself, right? In terms of the amount of time that's, I mean, the amount of space that's given. I mean, it's not massively different, but I think it is pretty significantly different. I think it reflects that if you're appealing, there's a certain investment of time that's needed that isn't as much as the investment of time that's needed if you are responding to an appeal. And that's reflected in the amount of space you have to make your points. So I think there's a rationale for giving the appellant more time than the response to the appeal, because the appeal itself narrows the issues. And then the response to the appeal is made to the appellate points that are made. And so that's why they also have less space. So I think that there's a rationale for saying 10 and then 7, or just 10 and 10. I don't have a problem with keeping it 10 and 10. But I think 10 business days is basically 2 weeks, and that makes sense. But if other people feel strongly and want to shorten both of them, you know, I could go along with that.
Thank you, Risa.
Anyone else feel very strongly? But if not, we'll keep kind of 10 for the appellate, 7 for response, 10 for a decision if it's administrative panel, and 15 for a response if it's a hearing panel. If not, going once, going twice. 3 times sold. So I will stop share on that. Those were the ones that we just needed to tie some loose ends, and we can move on to the public comment. I got a chance to look at some of those comments quite recently that came in since the last one was pulled at 5. Most of them, I think there were 5, I want to say, 4 being which please extend public comment, and 1 being which another on the standard of evidence, standard of proof. That was my quick reading of them as I stare in my other screen. But happy to entertain other people's thoughts on, you know, how to utilize some public comments. Obviously, all public comments will be shared with the university assembly as well and all that stuff, but kind of just want this free period of time to let people who had the chance to just raise points and everything like that to see if we should make changes to what our drafts are and everything like that. Yeah, Risa. Oops, you're muted.
There we go. So this is not on the public comments, but I wanted to raise something that I had last time raised that relates to the appellate points. And I don't recall if we made a change in that, which was that given that the complainant and the OSCCS, the scope of their appeals is, you know, basically based on the sanction piece. There was that one place in the appeals panel where it talked about reversing. Here it is on it's section 7.2, which says, I don't know if you want to put that up, Joe, so everybody can look at it. It says if the appeal panel reverses a finding of not responsible, the record on appeal would be supplemented with the party's impact mitigation statements. So I made the comment last time when we were talking about this, that this seems not to be a possibility for the appeal panel to reverse a finding of not responsible, given that the appellant is going to be appealing from a finding of being responsible, and the complainant and the OSCCS would be appealing on the basis of sanctions. So I think that needs to be changed. The impact mitigation statement, I guess we could think about being put in terms of whether they're relevant to the sanctions, but that it just doesn't seem like the not responsible reversal is relevant anymore.
Sorry, I was muted, James. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with that. I don't know if we would. I mean, it could be changed to if the appeal panel reverses the sanction. But it wouldn't be. Yeah, that's correct. It wouldn't be a finding of not responsible.
So I could sanction slash remedy, since that's the kind of language that we're using throughout. If I can put that there, and I think that makes sense.
Could I make one other suggestion?
Yeah.
Perhaps it would be better to say if the appeal panel is considering reversing sanctions slash remedies, then the record on appeal would be supplemented with the party's impact mitigation statements, because it seems like they would be considering those in terms of whether sanctions are appropriate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, James.
Yes, the only thing I'm thinking is if the OJA appeals the sanction, why wouldn't we just put the impact and mitigation statements in the appeal? Why would the appeal so I guess I'm just confused about what considering means. So is considering just any time the OJA appeals the sanction, then the impact mitigation statements would already get put in the record?
That's how I'm reading it. Risa, do you want to comment on that? But yeah, that's how I read it.
Actually, you know, I'm looking at the whole thing again. I'm not sure we need it at all. The first sentence says that the record on appeal, you know, the hearing record consists of la 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 pre-hearing written submissions and the impact mitigation statements if considered by the administrative or hearing panel. So they're already in the record. So it seems to me we could just drop that last sentence.
Perfect. Wonderful. Less words, the better. That's all I can say. Okay. Anyone else have things that they want to pull to the fore, whether it be from public comments, lingering thoughts, et cetera? This is basically kind of last minute ditch offensives. James, yeah.
So there are two points that
Oop, you got muted.
Sorry. Yeah, there are two points that the Office of the JCC wanted to bring up. And I don't know, you know, how doable it is to really change it at this point. I mean, this is something that the UA might have to consider and add in this amendment, but so one would be the idea of codifying the Good Samaritan policy. The Good Samaritan policy is, for essentially, I'm sure most people know about it, but if you call the police or something for your friend who's heavily intoxicated, or you call for yourself who's heavily intoxicated, it precludes the JA from charging you for consumption of alcohol. So that's not in the code as is. It's just kind of a policy that we have. We think it would be smart just to codify that. The New York State Legislature has codified a version of the Good Samaritan policy. I think it makes sense for us to do the same. But again, I mean, that's something that it is kind of late in the game to come up with new language now. So we could tackle that at a later date. And then the second question was on retroactivity. So in the situation where this code passes, let's say this goes into effect, you know, September 1st or something like that, adding a provision essentially that says that anyone who was charged under the code, or anyone who is charged before the new code goes into effect, nothing changes for them. So in other words, if someone, let's say, is preparing to go to a hearing thinking that the standard of proof is going to be clear and convincing on August 30th, and then this passes on September 1st and their meeting is September 2nd, they still, you know, nothing changes for them. They would still have that, what they were relying on, which was the old standard of proof and the old protocols. I think that's a pretty quick fix that we could put in if people want to discuss that. Otherwise, it's something we could talk about with the UA.
If it's okay, I'll ask the second question to Barb, since she and her office will be adjudicating if the new code comes into place in the fall. What Barb, not even like on the content, but like what is the OJA planning to do if a new code were to be passed?
I'm sorry, I actually was communicating offhand, trying to get clarification on something else and not listening well. So could maybe somebody state the comment quickly? I apologize.
Yeah. So one would be codifying Good Samaritan, which isn't in the code right now. Just a policy that Cornell has. I think the point being that that the New York State Legislature codified Good Samaritan, I think is a good reason why we should as well. And which would be hard to do now because it's late in the process and we recognize it. So it's something that we could discuss with the UA. The UA wants to add an amendment to it because we're not looking to prolong this unnecessarily. And then the second one would be on retroactivity of this code in the event. It might be smart to write something in this code saying that it won't apply to anyone who was already had a pending case by the time this is implemented. So if a student is on August 28th, getting ready for a hearing on September 2nd, and they think that the burden of proof is gonna be clear and convincing, and then this passes on September 1st, they would be subject to, for instance, the burden of proof in the previous code, just for reliance interests.
So typically, I think the most common way that retroactivity is dealt with in codes like this is to say that substantive provisions, in other words, the parts that define what the misconduct is, would apply retroactively. So it's the code in effect at the time somebody did something allegedly in violation of the code. It would be that substantive provisions in effect at the time that would govern. And most often, in my experience, the procedures that are in place would be the ones that are in effect at the time the hearing actually takes place. So I believe that's, I think that's what the conduct office will do whatever the code says it should do. I don't know whether counsel's office would have an opinion on this from a legal compliance perspective. Which I guess is true for all of the conversations that we've had about this proposed revision, but that would be, I guess, my starting point. And if this committee wanted to do something else or recommend something else, of course, this committee should do that.
I'm comfortable adding a section 9 for both, you know, if we want to add one section on the grandfathering of this document, like those who were received a formal complaint or, you know, formal notice of investigation under the code that was active in the spring 2020 2020 semester will be adjudicated through the policies and procedures per the campus code of conduct of the spring of 2019. This code of conduct shall take effect, you know, blah. I'm happy to add a section 9 to that if that would, you know, ease concerns across the board.
Or Joe, just at the beginning of the document or on the website or wherever it gets posted, just a statement that says the code of conduct goes into effect on whatever day it goes into effect. I don't know if you necessarily need to add a whole nother section. You know, I was just thinking about academic policy, and students are grandfathered into the academic catalog they come in under unless they petition to change to other records. You know this, right? Like, so maybe we just post wherever we post it that says goes into effect on this date. A section seems like a lot.
Okay. Yeah, James.
Yeah, I think we should just add to the document. To be honest, I think that makes sense. I mean, we could put it on the website, but if we could put it in the actual code itself, I think that would just make things a little bit more concrete. And if a student is being charged with something and, you know, they're looking through the, or they, you know, they have something that's pending and they're looking through the codes that are being proposed, they'd be able to see it for sure.
Yeah, I could just do the effective date of these procedures and it could be a singular sentence, the effective date of these procedures shall be, you know, TBD, depending on when the world works, and then all current cases from the spring 2020 semester shall be adjudicated using the campus code of conduct from the spring 2020 semester. I feel like that can solve the problem. Again, the compliance perspective, I don't know. You know, if that's what people want to do, you know, I don't have a particular viewpoint. If people don't want it, yeah, Risa.
Joe, do you mind? Oh, sorry.
I'm happy
to
wait. I'm happy to wait. I don't know who was wanting to talk, but I'm happy to wait if somebody else wants to talk.
I was just going to say.
Was that Marissa? Yeah.
Yeah. I was just going to say that the language as you've typed it right now doesn't necessarily clarify. I guess my concern would be whether the conduct occurred during the spring 2020 semester or, you know, like sometimes there's a lapse between when folks are charged and when conduct occurs. So I can see some people getting caught in the middle here and it not being entirely clear.
Yeah, which is why I don't necessarily want to codify it, because I think if we just attach or, you know, I think it makes more sense to just do what Jen suggested, because I think there's more of a degree that allows people flexibility. But, you know, yeah, Risa.
Yeah, I mean, one thing we could do is a little research based on like what Jen had raised to say, well, how has this been done before when we've just said effective date? Do we have an understanding from other documents, other approaches that means that all pending matters prior to the effective date are to be dealt with both substantively and procedurally under the provisions that existed as of the time of the conduct or as of the time of the charge? Do we have that information from, you know, what Cornell has generally done? It would be really helpful to know if what we were doing is consistent with what's happened before. And I mean, I think policy-wise, it seems like what we would want is, number one, all pending matters, all charges that have been brought at this point, or all charges brought prior to the effective date will be adjudicated under the substantive and procedural provisions in effect at the time that the charges were brought, right? I mean, that would seem like a minimum. And I guess my question is, to James, is that what you were raising?
Yeah, I think that makes sense. Just because I do see where situations where it would be a little annoying, but it would not be annoying for very long. It would only be if this went into effect next semester and there were still some pending cases that had to be adjudicated. You know, we have some different, because the procedures would be a little bit different, like the amount of days and everything. But I think, like, fundamentally, they're reliance interests that if someone, especially is like relying on a specific burden of proof and then this goes into effect, that shouldn't be changed if it's already been pending.
I think, this is Jen, a good idea. I mean, we don't print this document out and pass it out to people very often, right? So on the website, wherever it is, we just have them both posted for all violations prior to this date, click here. For all violations moving forward, click here. I don't know. I just think we're making, we're having like a really long discussion about something that, and I think that the students can, that those questions can be explained in their initial intake meeting or their, you know, I don't know.
Yeah,
Joe, it's in your hands.
I have to agree with Jenna. I have to agree with Jen on this, and then I'll let Marissa speak real quick. I think this is not something that we should, you know, spend time to litigate and place inside of the procedures document because it, you know, it won't matter after a couple semesters. I think if anything, it should be guidance sent from the OJA to anyone who's currently going through a case, affirming that you'll still be under the same code of conduct, the spring code of conduct and the procedures of the spring 2020 semester. And anything, any new conduct that exists in the fall, if we have a fall semester, who knows, will be adjudicated through a different, through the code that is ratified coming into the fall of 2020 semester. I don't think we need to make this overly complex in the moment. I think this is pretty, you know, in my mind, cut and dry. I mean, I think simplicity can't be beat, but, you know, Marissa.
Yeah, so just really quickly to Reese's point about consistency, this came up recently within updated faculty procedures for 6-4. And what they did was just said if the conduct occurred when, like, if the conduct occurred, let's say in spring 2020, then that's when the code, that's the code that applies. So even if you're being charged in the fall, it's just based on the conduct. And I think, you know, that's made it really clear for people.
Perfect. Then I think if people are comfortable not having this as an immediate section inside of it, then we could ask the OJA to put out that guidance to anyone who, you know, just ask the OJA to do that, you know, just as a formal action of the committee, you know, as a separate motion, if that's okay with people, because then we have recorded documentation on that and a recorded vote on that, rather than having it codified, because I don't think it needs to be. If people are comfortable with that motion, I would appreciate a second into a vote.
Second.
Thank you. Okay, if people could use the check boxes for the vote, that would be appreciated. Okay, perfect. 5-0-1. We've asked the OJA to make that notice. You can just chat it, Andrea, if you want to. privately or publicly, but thank you. So 6-0-1, if the OJA could send out that guidance or place that guidance on their website, that would be very helpful. I'll inform the UA of that action as well. So that is put into the record of the UA too. So thank you on that. On the Good Samaritan, I think just to push through on the comments that we have, I would, prefer, that being readdressed in the fall of 2020, if codifying that, just as a workflow issue, but any other public comments that people want to raise? I'm happy. Yeah. Risa, then Bryce.
One is procedural, but I'm going to set that aside. There were a lot of comments on the standard of proof. We expected that, but I think that that we should pay attention to the fact that there were a lot of comments on the standard of proof. There were a lot of comments on the issue of public hearings. I don't know if we expected that or not, but I think it's also significant that there were a lot of comments on that. And on the standard of proof, I don't remember whose this is from, but there was something in there, I think with somebody without a name attached to it. So I just don't remember for sure. But there was something that made me think about an alternative to what we've done. I mean, so at this point, the committee majority has voted in favor of moving to preponderance of evidence. Seems to me another possibility for us to think about is moving to clear and convincing evidence for all the matters that go in front of a hearing panel, i.e. disciplinary probation, suspension, and expulsion, because the stakes are very high, and keep preponderance for the administrative panel. Now, as you all know, I think clear and convincing evidence is the appropriate standard for everything, but it seems to me that this is another position that would take into account the high stakes of life-altering sanctions, and that could actually meet the concerns of due process. And this actually relates to the fact that at this point, all hearings will be private. And even if that were changed to be some hearings public, there would be very few hearings that would be public. Most of them will be private. At this point, all of them will be private. And that where you have a closed hearing that is in and of itself a due process concern, but it may be justified to have a closed hearing. But if you have a closed hearing, you don't have the kind of check that public hearings have in terms of due process on the situation. You don't have any kind of oversight from the public. So in a private hearing where you don't use the rules of evidence, and you have decisions made, by people who are, not judges, they're doing the best they can with good training, I think that a higher standard of proof makes sense to say just 50% plus something is not enough to make these kinds of potential life-altering decisions. So I think that it makes sense to do that. And I just note that somebody in a comment somewhere in what we got said something about like the academic integrity hearings or preponderance. Now, unless they've been changed since I have dealt with them, they are clear and convincing evidence. And I actually was on a panel where it mattered that it was clear and convincing evidence. Okay, so I see a chat that they are clear and convincing evidence. So, I think that's a reflection of, again, the potential life-altering quality of what could happen. So I want to propose that we reconsider that issue along the lines that I've said.
Okay. Thank you. Several hands. I know I had Bryce after Risa. So Bryce.
Yeah, so I think we should discuss that first. I think that's a very good idea.
Okay. Wonderful. So we'll move into a reconsideration of it, as long as the hands stayed stagnant. I have Logan, Jen, then James. So Logan, go for it.
You're muted.
Thanks, Jen. I realized I didn't introduce myself because there's quite a few new faces. So I'm looking at Bryce, who I've never met before. Hi, I'm Logan. I'm the former chair of the CJC, and I'm a current voting member of the UA. So I just wanted to, quickly speak to the burden, which I guess you guys are going to discuss in a second anyway. But a lot of the new comments that came in overnight were talking about the standard of proof, and they were from law students and anonymous sources. And I'm one of the two people in the UA that said that we will not vote through the preponderance standard, and that we're looking to get back to clear and convincing. And I'm very strict by that. I also want to quickly note on the public hearings and say that came up quite a lot in the comments, and I think it's really important for the committee to reconsider that also. It doesn't happen a lot, and it's just an opportunity where potential minority students or just, it's a great educational experience if there's a huge issue across campus, and it just gives people the right to be adequately heard. I don't want to take away time from discussion, but I did feel like it was important to tell you all that I am a voting member of the UA, and I'm very much opposed to the lower burden of proof. And I think that's important for the committee to know that there's at least two of us. And I did move to extend the public comment period at our last meeting, and I lost, but the vote was 7-6. It was miscounted, but it was 7-6, and it was very close, and a lot of students are asking for a longer period of time. And the fact that new things are being changed today and public comment is ending today is very, very concerning for my main point that students don't have enough time.
Jen.
Hi, Logan. Good to see you. I had my hand up, but I took it down. No disrespect, but I feel like that's a threat to the committee based on something that a UA member is going to vote against. Preponderance of evidence is a clear standard. I want to apologize for not having my video on. My kid's birthday is today, so it's chaos behind me. So I apologize. I'm not trying to avoid you all, but I have a 12-year-old jumping around everywhere. thank you. I'm on. Took the rest of the day off. So I don't even know how to express the preponderance of evidence does give students process. It does give them the ability. And there's two things, right? The disciplinary probation, keeping that in and saying it's detrimental to like a student's future, or that it's such a big deal. I think there's two pieces to that that are stressful. One is that the president clearly says that she wants disciplinary probation to be seen as a lesser charge and move to the other office, but we're not talking about that. I know that I'm going to lose this vote, as I've lost many votes on this committee. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not, I don't have the skill set like that, like a legal mind. I don't do that work. I do student development work. And I have been in this position, my type of work, for almost 20 years, which is frightening in so many ways. Preponderance of evidence is the standard. I went through all the codes that the president put in her charge initially from the colleges that she wanted us to look at as we rewrote ours. And I would just hope that people would really do some research, think about how preponderance does really do what colleges need a code of conduct to do, and that it should be the standard.
Yeah, I'll let Logan respond real quick.
Yeah, so I just want to respond to say that in no way was that meant to be a threat, and I don't know how it came across as one. I just believe that as a member of the UA, and that this was discussed on Tuesday, I think it's very important for your committee to know that that was a big point of discussion. Letting you know how I choose to vote isn't threatening you. I'm also not telling you how to vote in this committee. So I feel very odd to have been told that I was threatening you all, especially it seems sort of like an attack for just giving my own opinion, and it's free speech. And I just want to say that I believe in the restorative justice system that we spoke about in the beginning of the year, that we spoke about with the University Counsel's Office. And moving to a lower burden of proof is more punitive in every single way and leads to potentially wrongful convictions, even if people say no. And I see Barbara shaking her head. But when there are individuals using terms like accused and making it close to a criminal court system, we have to realize that these charges, if a student is found responsible and it's on their transcript and they have this record, it follows them for the rest of their lives, and it's very severe. And lowering the burden to make it easier to find someone guilty could potentially ruin someone's life if they didn't actually do the crime, and there's bias that comes in or privilege that comes into play that sways committee members' decisions.
Yeah, I think we can recognize that intent doesn't always match impact on statements that we say, but I'll move to James.
So on the evidence standard, yeah, I think Reese's point is a good one, which is that there could be some compromise here. I understand what the OJA is saying, that this is in a sense an educational process and a clear and convincing standard, especially for an administrative panel where the way it's written is not going to require live in-person testimony, and if it's something like a written reprimand. Or less than disciplinary probation, then it could make sense to have preponderance. But expulsion, suspension, we've talked about this at length, but it becomes less educational. If someone's getting expelled from the university, you'll learn something, but it won't necessarily be educational. I think that it's a good way to kind of compromise. I also think it's important to kind of look at the optics of this. And one thing I gleaned from looking at the public comments is that, we are in a global pandemic, and I know, this committee has been doing work for a while, and there's, obviously no intent to like rush through a lower standard of proof while everyone is off campus, but it would be, I think it would be malpractice for us to ignore optics of people who, don't know anything about the process and how this may be portrayed like in the Sun and to the general community. So I think that having some type of bifurcated process is a good idea, especially given the public comments and the criticism that the proposal is going to get. I think the second point on public hearings, so I went back and I researched a little bit, and especially the Mitch McBride hearing, which I guess happened 3 years ago. I think that's, a pretty good situation where the public hearing lived up to its utility and probably the reason why it was included in the last code. It was, a question of, a hotly contested issue on campus. The hearing wasn't live, but it was streamed to a room, and like a lot of people showed up to that, and a lot of people were interested in that. And people were upset that the Mitch McBride hearing wasn't in, live in person. They were already so upset that it was streamed virtually. So I think if there's another situation where an issue like that comes up, a campus leader, president of the student assembly is charged with something, an administrative issue, and people want to see the process, I think that's the type of situation where we should have a public hearing. And I looked at the article. I saw Joe that you were in that hearing that you live streamed. So I'd be interested to hear your thoughts as well.
I mean, my hope is that no leader of the student assembly ever would have to be put in that position ever again. And that's a leadership integrity issue that I've instilled in my leadership teams as president of the student assembly. I don't have a particular strong viewpoint. I think I've lost my strong viewpoint. Chair, I think my goal as chair is less to do my strong viewpoints along this semester, but I'll let Risa go into this comment.
Okay, yeah, so we've got, I've already told you what I think about the clear and convincing. I think it's a good approach. I think it's consistent with our academic integrity approach. for the these higher stakes. On the public hearing piece, I was involved with the divestment movement here in the mid-1980s, and I was on a hearing review panel on that, and it was public, where students were suspended because of political activities. So it wasn't a situation of, you know, where a chair could reasonably say, oh, well, we've got individuals and keeping it private makes sense. It was essential for that to be public. There would have been massive protests had it not been public. And I think very rational, well-based protests if it had not been public, because it was a public issue. It affected the university as a whole. So it's similar to what James is raising. So I think these are the kinds of hearings that would be public, not interrelational sort of questions that would be highly sensitive to air in public. So it's the provision that allows for respondent to request a public hearing also allows for the chair to say no, there are countervailing considerations. I think it's very important. I think that's why people are raising it. And then on the issue of the kind of, you know, the fact that we're doing this in the middle of the pandemic, I've raised this multiple times. I'm going to raise it again. I've also been here where the administration rushed through some changes to the code. Whether the administration's view of this was that their view was that it wasn't rushed through, it was perceived that way, and everybody was furious about some of the changes. That was with the RAMPO stuff. I think everybody here, we are all acting in good faith, but that doesn't make a difference to what we're talking about. That is, in the middle of a pandemic, when people can barely keep up with their everyday lives, when they don't have sick relatives and they aren't looking at not being able to pay the rent and they're not sick themselves, even if you don't have those things, keeping up every day is impossible. And so I think what we should also do is, I think we should look at these substantive pieces again, but on this process piece, that we should at the very least say, what can we do to extend the comment period now, build in kind of a town hall through Zoom, as inadequate as Zoom is, but build in a town hall where people can air their views so that we simply move the dates a bit. My understanding is that the UA would be considering the code on the 12th of May, if I'm understanding that correctly. Why can't that be moved a bit farther, or if it's, you know, a few days even. But even if it's not moved from the 12th, between now and the 12th, there's time for a public hearing and to extend the comment period. And in line with the comment period, I'll just add one other thing so I can get it all out on the table. I don't understand why the free speech document that we worked on hasn't been posted for people to look at. If it is posted, I haven't seen it. So I'm wondering about getting some comments on that as well. And I'm not even sure what it looks like ultimately, you know, what we ended up with. I don't have a final document on that. Okay, I'll stop now.
Yeah, I can address the last point and then kind of go backwards. You know, just from as chair, I prioritized a workflow perspective from this. You know, I had to, you know, given the instructions and directions, I had to recognize that the substantive code and the procedures had to be put first as quickly as possible and kind of get finished. So, I mean, it's definitely not me saying that that document isn't important. It's just I have to kind of balance as much as possible and, you know, under the time crunch that I was given, you know, I don't think I think we're all operating under good faith, and I appreciate the work that this committee has done 100%. And, you know, I've said, you know, at the end of every meeting. And so the way the dates were chosen, the May 12th is the last date that classes were in session, you know, and so the UA leadership thought it was the most fair last meeting for students so that they didn't have to go into their finals period. And it's also the last possible opportunity for us to get something to the board meeting in May. That was just kind of the rationale given. And so, I mean, you know, of course, you know, and I say this all the time, of course, I wish we had more time. And I can raise the issue again with UA leadership and say, hey, like, let's, you know, we can try to do it. you know, ultimately, like, I want to balance our respect of the work done and the, you know, respect of the process. So it's kind of, I'm always put in an awkward position because I want to recognize the fact that we did do this in a very quick time and I appreciate the work. And so I would love to see a conclusion to the work. However, you know, there is a concept of process and, you know, necessary public input. And so, you know, I struggle with that as an individual, and I try to balance that. But I can raise the issue with UA leadership again to say that this was a conversation that we had, you know, per multiple public comments that we received. And, you know, we can act, you know, can ask them to act upon that.
But at the very least, can't we as a committee decide to extend public comments for some period of time and build in a public forum, even if the 12th is left alone?
Yeah, I mean, we can. That would just require people to be comfortable, you know, potentially meeting next week, Friday. And also, I think we also need to make sure that so this is another piece. The UA requires two meetings of the finalized document to ratify the document. So they see the final document this Tuesday, and then they vote on the 12th. So that's per required rules on this. So we're certainly, and the rationale for that is to allow the public to comment more straight to the UA. Instead of commenting to the CJC, they comment to the UA. Obviously, the way we've done this is that the public comments ultimately to the CJC do get fed to the UA. So I'm happy to leave the public comments open for another week, extended to Friday, and then allow that consolidation. And we don't see it, but we just send that to the UA if people feel like that's a you know, reasonable thing. And then, you know, we could potentially try to find a date next week as an independent forum of CJC members to allow people to just say what they need to say to us. And we can think through these things and we can write it down and pass that to the UA. But I think a lot, you know, and I want to also be able to address, Risa, your substantive points of reconsidering public hearings and stuff like that. So I'm going to wrap this up kind of quickly. We don't have much of a role anymore other than encouraging people to continue commenting just because of how the UA functionality needs to work with this. So I think that, it's a thing. And then Gina has just messaged me that we can do an all campus email, a final all campus email to just drive the last public comment straight to the UA as well. So, I mean, this is, you know, and I can do that, but I think this is, you know, for what we play as a role, we don't have much more of one to make those changes just because of the UA requiring those two meetings per their bylaws. I mean, we obviously play a role in encouraging people to come in and coming to the UA meeting and saying, we're a CJC member, here's our thoughts and opinions. And, you know, there was a division. I try to explain the divisions as best as possible to people. So, but I want to just reach the substantive points, seeing that we have 7 minutes left. And I'm happy to get a vote to reconsider, to say that we prefer all hearings to be private with the exceptions that were originally built into the language, originally built into the procedures that we voted on. If I think that, you know, satisfies a lot, because I think those exceptions built in educational components and kind of prevented interpersonal harm. And I'm also happy to entertain a vote on having the administrative panel being preponderance for the hearing panel be clear and convincing, and I will communicate those two votes to the UA in our Tuesday meeting as well. So I can do that if people are comfortable with those two motions.
Can I quickly ask for the public hearing? Would it be how it is now, where anyone can request a public hearing and it's at the discretion of the chair to allow to not allow one to happen?
It would be upon, so there would be, you know, outlined exceptions, and then the chair would make a ruling on that, you know. So I believe the original language we had written, let me see if I can find it, I'll have to go back into the old document, but I think there are exceptions built into it, and so it'd be in that document.
Okay.
So I will ask for a vote on the public hearing aspect. So those who wish to allow for public hearings with the exceptions that we discussed earlier, you know, earlier in the semester, early in the procedure, just click yes. Those who want to keep all hearings private, just click no.
Sorry, can you restate that?
Yeah. So if you want to make the change to allow for public hearings with certain, you know, allow for some public hearings, click yes. If you want to maintain all hearings be private, you know, click no.
And it was as originally written where the public hearings would be allowed if the respondent asked for one and, but the chair could rule that there are countervailing considerations like witnesses who shouldn't be made, you know, public or something like that.
Yeah. Yes, that is correct. So that since this was a reconsidered vote, it's a reconsidered vote, but the way we've done votes is that essentially we've just put out the committee's opinion. So this is the committee's opinion after reading public comments. That's how I'm interpreting this vote. So the final vote on that was 5-1-1 to allow that to happen. So I did that. The next one I have is the vote on having the hearing panel be clear and convincing and administrative panel be preponderance of the evidence. So that's the question on the table. So yes, if you like that idea, and no, if you want to maintain, maybe the same at whatever level is recognized. Jen, did I answer your question?
So are we voting on a code of conduct that has two separate standards of proof?
That would be how I'm interpreting it based off the procedures. So if you went to the administrative panel, your standard of proof would be preponderance, but if you went to hearing, your standard of evidence would be clear and convincing.
And disciplinary probation is still in a hearing?
Yeah, that is correct. So yes, if you want to bifurcate, and no, if you want there to be a uniform amongst the two.
Well, you mean uniform preponderance?
Uniform preponderance are uniform of whatever the UA recommends. So if the UA decides to,
That's not the motion that I understood. The motion is to change it to the bifurcation or leave it as preponderance completely. That's what we have so far.
Yeah. That is the motion currently standing, but we also have to take into account if the UA does change, you know, what does that look like? But they would probably just change the whole entire thing. So yes, you are correct. I'm just thinking, you know, what the UA might think.
Yeah, I just want to be clear on what people are voting on.
Yeah. The no would be uniform at the preponderance standard, yes. Okay, by a vote of 6-1-1. After public comment, the CJC recommends a bifurcated model in standard of evidence. So I will do that. I will make those changes and communicate that to the UA. I will also communicate that we'll be extending public comment into the next week. I'll work with Gina to get that mass email out. I will go through these documents and try to standardize language as best as possible and send those to you as quickly as possible before I send them to the UA. Risa, then Jen.
Well, thanks for fitting all this in. I also want to suggest that in extending the public comments that we also schedule a time for kind of a town hall public forum.
Mm-hmm. I will also work on scheduling. I'll send out a when to meet to the committee. I would love to have as many of you there as possible. So I'll send out a when to meet to the whole committee to ask when is best, and then we'll set that as the town hall date. Yep, Jen?
I just want to know when, so with this change, when would be the time that we vote on what we move forward to the UA? Like, when is that going to be?
That would be once I clean these documents, kind of get them in final form. I don't know if we're going to be able to do that vote in person. If we want to do it in person, I can try to schedule something quick on Monday, like a quick 30-minute chunk for us to sit down and just like vote on it, or if people are comfortable with the email, but I can do whatever people want to do. If we want to schedule something for Monday, I'm happy to schedule that out with you all.
So even though you're extending public comment, we're still going to clean this up and move it forward to the UA for its next meeting.
Yeah, because the public comment extension isn't for us. It would be for the UA to recognize those public comments.
I would appreciate a chance to read the whole thing in clean form and then take a vote of the committee.
Okay. I will schedule a quick 30-minute meeting for Monday with all of you. So there are going to be two when to meets out, if that's okay with everyone. So everyone has that. Okay. That's it for everyone. Greatly appreciate all of you as always. I mean, getting even closer to the end, even if it's through the bumpiest of circumstances. But other than that, I greatly appreciate all of you and everything that you do, and, you know, and recognizing the different viewpoints of everyone. It's just, you know, it's a hard process, and I can't say that it was easy, and I can't say that this was fun and this was perfect, but I can definitely say that it's in a semester, it's amazing to see what we've been able to accomplish. You know, it just quite honestly, like, I've never been able to work with such a group like this in my time in Chair Government. So I'm greatly appreciative, but.
And honestly,
to all of you, let me know. Yeah.
We owe it to you. Like, you're a senior in college, you're about to graduate, you've had to deal with this transition, and that is a tremendous amount of work. I can't say thank you enough from me, and I'm sure from everybody in the committee, that you've done a great job. You picked up, Logan led us fearlessly in the beginning, and not only did you pick it up, but then you were sent home to finish your senior year in college. So we do appreciate it, Joe, and thank you so much. It's all of our frustration is not at you.
I thank you. I appreciate that so much from all of you. And thank you. We will see each other again on Monday for a quick 30 minutes. And, you know, all I can say is, if I don't get a chance, you know, after that meeting, see you again. I'm greatly appreciative. I know I didn't do everything perfectly all the time, but it's a great experience just to have with all of you and be able to spend my Friday mornings with you all. So, I mean, great. I'm thankful from like the bottom of my heart. I just cannot say it enough. I'm always grateful to the teams that I work with, but thank you so much to everyone. See you on Monday. Expect to see some emails from me. And, you know, yeah, thank you.
This has been a production of Cornell University on the web at cornell.edu.